must write with warmth and humor. A novelist who wishes to tell the later, sadder story of the dissolution of a marriage must write with delicacy and compassion. A novelist who wishes to tell the story of a man trying to maintain his identity as an artist in a world gone mad must write with deep insight and clarity. And a novelist who chooses France and England during World War I as her backdrop for all of these stories, that novelist is either crazy or very, very sure of her story. I have only had the pleasure of meeting Emily Mitchell very recently, but I'm fairly certain that she is not crazy. She is instead the author of The Portrait of Photographer Edward Steichen. It's entitled The Last Summer of the World. She's also a novelist possessed of all the storytelling skills I listed. And we are fortunate that she is now a member of the MFA program here at WVU. She's a colleague to a number of you here, and for the rest of us, even more fortunately, a teacher, soon to be. So I'm honored to be introducing Emily Mitchell.
Thank you. That was a lovely introduction. I'm also fairly certain I'm not crazy. This is my first reading in Morgantown. I'm really pleased to be here. I am going to read a section from my novel, The Last Summer of the World, which just came out in paperback in July. Can you hear me? People at the back, more or less, roughly? Okay. The novel looks at the service during World War I of the American photographer Edward Steichen, who flew and took and organized aerial reconnaissance for the American army during that conflict. Steichen is probably best known now for his celebrity portraits from the 1930s that he took when he was photographer at Vanity Fair and Vogue. But before that, Steichen was an art photographer who was good friends with Alfred Stieglitz and a pioneer of photography as an art form in the very early years of the 20th century. And he lived for many years in France and was responsible for bringing a lot of avant-garde French art to the United States for the first time. So when World War One broke out, Steichen and his family became refugees from that war and returned to the States, and Steichen went back then later to fight in that conflict. Now, the novel tells the story both of Steichen's years before the war and of his service during the war, and I'm going to read a chapter that is set early in the chronology of the book, during the time when Steichen was courting his first wife, Clara Steichen. And the chapter is called Two Women, Ile de la Cité, 1903 Pigment Print. I don't think there's anything you guys need to know before this chapter begins, except that Edward and Clara have met about a year before and are engaged at this time. She's never seen him act like this before. He's restless and uneasy. Several times during dinner, he jumps up from the table and paces the room for no reason. He's not really listening to a word anyone says. He just nods and looks away towards the dark squares of the windows. She doesn't know what to make of it. Usually he's so attentive to the people around him, to her. When Marion Beckett asks him about the exhibition in London, he changes the subject right away. Usually he likes nothing more than to discuss his work, especially with Marion, who generally has insightful and useful things to say. Clara wonders if perhaps he's tired from his journey. He arrived home just this morning, but that would explain only the dark circles under his eyes, the fatigued way he leans his elbows on the table, not the agitation, this energy that seems to have no specific purpose. Even Arthur notices. What is wrong, Ed? All night you've been wriggling around like a fish on a hook. Nothing's wrong. I don't believe you. Miss Smith, what have you been doing to him? Or is this how all young men act when they're 6 months engaged? I haven't been doing anything to him, Clara says, typical of Arthur to be so appallingly crass. You must remember, Mr. Carlos, I've not seen him in a week. There must be some other girl who's driving him to distraction. Don't be ridiculous, darling, Edward says. He fishes in his jacket pocket for his cigarette case, then goes over to the open window and leans out of it. He lights a cigarette, flinging the match into the darkness below. "I know," he announces, so the whole room can hear. "Let's all walk down to the river and look at the cathedral. This is too nice of an evening to be cooped up indoors. Who's coming?" "I'm in," Arthur stands up. Never short of enthusiasm, at least. "Marvelous idea," says Leo Stein. "It's a sight worth seeing on a clear night." "Isn't it very spooky?" Clara asks. "Not at all. It's magnificent." There are murmured affirmatives from the rest of the dinner party. Mildred, Marion, Lottie, and a boy called Billy Paddock who is courting her. "Good," says Edward. "Let's go." Then there's a scramble for hats and jackets as they make their way into the hallway, down the stairs, and out into the evening street. Edward comes last, a quietly triumphant grin on his face. He loves things like this, loves to be the one who directs the next scene, who decides where the players will stand. He's good at it. People follow his lead naturally. He takes Clara's arm, and she feels the flush, that flush of excitement that comes over her when he is around. They have known each other now for more than a year, and she still experiences that same dizzying sweetness when he touches her. "Oh," he says suddenly, "let me just run home and get my camera." "Must you?" Clara asks. "Won't you walk with the rest of us?" "It will only take me 3 minutes. I've wanted to shoot that place at night for ages." "Well, I'll come with you then, for the walk." "Oh, no, darling, there's no need. You go ahead. I'll meet you on the bridge." He is already several paces down the street, waving them to go on without him. "What he means is that he really wants to take more pictures of his lovely fiancée," says Arthur. "Well, in that case," Clara says, "I give him my blessing. Go on, Ed, I'll escort the lady." And he puts his arm through Clara's before she can say anything to object. Edward nods and blows her a kiss, then runs off down the street without another word. She stares after him. He has never made that gesture before, and at the moment it seems to her like the combination of a cough and the motion one makes when swatting a troublesome insect. She cannot shake the sense that there has been something evasive about his actions this evening. Something is wrong, and she is going to find out what it is. She turns to Arthur with her sweetest and most engaging smile. "Shall we go?" she asks. Edward walks towards the river, feeling buoyant, swinging his arms. His camera case hangs on a strap across his shoulders. It feels good to be outside at last, to be walking, to lose himself a little in the motion of his own limbs. The evening streets are crowded with people and noisy with the sounds of their talk and laughter. He makes his way along Boulevard Saint-Michel, past the red awnings and the open doors of restaurants that spill sharp electric light onto the pavement, through the dull orange flicker of the street lamps where the shadows of strangers turn like clock hands and vanish. He is thinking about Kathleen. He knows he should not be thinking about her, but he has told himself to stop 100 times, and none of his attempts have worked, so he has given up censuring his own brain, and instead is floating quietly along on the memory of her hands, the way she has of opening her eyes very wide when she wants to say something serious. She really does have wonderful hands, long, articulate fingers, each knuckle a little rough and dry, where the clay she used for modeling has sucked out all the moisture. He inhales deeply and feels a precarious exhilaration. The street around him resonates in sympathy. This city, he thinks, is like magic, a trick of the light. You can drink it through your skin. Does Clara suspect something? He dismisses this thought. Of course she doesn't. What is there for her to suspect? Almost nothing. He has hardly done anything wrong. He met Kathleen Bruce last year when he was in London for an exhibition. She introduced herself and complimented him on some prints of the Brooklyn Bridge he'd taken. It turned out she was an artist herself, a sculptor. They liked each other right away. Since then, they have written letters back and forth, mostly about their work, a little about their lives outside it. When she came to visit Paris earlier in the summer, he showed her some of the sights. They dined together and attended the theater. She met Clara, and the two of them got along famously. After that, they had continued to correspond, and when she learned he would be in London to exhibit again this year, he wrote and told her. She made arrangements to come down by train from Edinburgh to stay with an aunt who owned a house in Kensington. "This time," she wrote, "I can be your guide." But then there was that afternoon, just 2 days before he was due to return to Paris. They were walking in Hyde Park together, Kathleen's idea, intending to stroll over to Kensington Palace. They were alone. Edward was in a bad mood. His prints had sold badly, and he believed it was because of where they'd been hung, a rear corner of the exhibition hall, in bad light. Kathleen had sympathized, but she'd seemed distracted, sad for some reason she didn't explain, and the conversation had slowed and then stopped altogether. "What's wrong?" he asked her. She didn't reply right away, just kept walking, looking away from him so he couldn't see the expression on her face. He took her wrist and pulled her around towards him. Her face was contorted, her mouth held in the rigid effort of a smile. "You must be stupid to ask that," she said. Then, "I'm sorry, please excuse me. I don't know what I'm saying." She cleared her throat. "Why don't you walk me home? I don't feel like seeing the palace today after all." "No," he said. He held onto her wrist. "I don't want you to go home yet." "Oh, don't," she replied. She sounded tired. "Playing the overwrought romantic doesn't suit you, Edward. I'm sure your fiancé would agree. Will you take me home, or do I have to go by myself?" Irritated, he let go of her hand, and they walked out of the park. They hailed a cab to take them the rest of the way. They sat in silence as the streets rolled by the open windows, and at the end of her aunt's road, Kathleen reached up and knocked on the ceiling. When the cab stopped, she held out her hand to him. "Well, goodbye," she said, her voice wooden. He took her hand, and instead of the perfunctory shake that she'd intended for it, he drew it up and kissed it slowly, one small knuckle after another. She pulled it away, a sharp, angry motion, and for a minute he thought she might smack him, but then she was kissing him and he forgot about everything else. It is this kiss which pulls him into its whirlpool, drawing him down so he tastes her mouth again, feels her body rise against him in the shaded interior of the cab. He tries not to remember it. It was only once, after all, and afterwards they had fallen away from each other, guilty, unable to speak. Kathleen had wiped her mouth with the back of her hand, slowly, still watching him as she did, her eyes slitted narrow like a cat's. "Edward," Clara calls from across the street. The sound of her voice breaks in on him, and he starts as though he has been discovered doing something illicit. There is the whole party waiting for him on the riverward side of Key Montebello. He waves and calls out, "Hello, darling," then wonders if he sounds too falsely hearty. He crosses towards them. Clara comes and slides her arm through his, and they move off across the bridge. In the middle, she stops to look down at the black water slipping away beneath them. "How I love rivers," she says, and cranes her neck down to peer into this one. "It's so dark, you can't see anything in its surface, not even us." Through the sleeve of his shirt, he can feel her body pressed against his arm, and when he leans down to see what she sees, he smells the dark scent of her hair. He looks into the water where she is pointing, and she is right. There is nothing beneath them to show they exist at all. But for the fact they can sense each other's life and warmth and solidity, they might easily be ghosts. He has an overwhelming feeling of tenderness, of wanting to protect her from the world, from the worst parts of himself. Surely this feeling is love, he thinks. This is what separates love from all those other transient desires that we lazily call by its name. And then, suddenly, he is terribly sorry for what he has done. The cathedral rises into the darkness until it disappears at night. The great rose window looks like an empty eye, the arched doors like open mouths. Gas lamps send a dim, wavering glow over the hunched figures of the patriarchs and saints that crowd the western face. "Like bees," Marion says, and Clara thinks that this is a good way to describe them. "For years," Leo says, "there was no stained glass in the nave, since the revolution, in fact. It's only recently that they've restored the windows to their original state." "I don't care what you say," Clara says, "it is spooky." They walk around to the side of the building. When they are a little way from the others, Clara says to Marion, "Edward seems out of sorts this evening, doesn't he? Perhaps he's tired." "Oh no, I don't think it's only that. He seems, well, so absent, like his head is somewhere else entirely. I don't know what's gotten into him." Marion sighs. "I think I know what it might be," she says. "Something to do with his trip to London. I don't know whether I should tell you or not. Oh, you must, says Clara. Are you sure? I could be wrong about this. You know, wouldn't it be better simply to ask him yourself if there's anything the matter? Men don't tell you things just because you ask them. Well, I would hope if you were marrying them, they might. Just tell me what you heard. All right. Marion draws her away along the side of the cathedral. They find one of the wooden park benches and sit down on it. They are almost fully immersed in shadow, so they can hardly see each other's faces. Something unexpected happened while he was in England. Mildred told me this at the exhibition. Well, the photograph he took at the show, they didn't sell, or not very many of them. Mildred said it was a great disappointment for him, all told. He thinks they were put away in a corner where people couldn't see them. He was quite angry. Apparently he argued with Fred Holland Day about it. I don't think that they parted on good terms. Oh, the poor thing, Clara cries. Why didn't he tell me? Well, perhaps he didn't want to burden you with it. Think about it. He's getting married to you next year. He wants to be certain he can provide for his wife. He doesn't have family wealth to fall back on like some of us, so he must earn money. He doesn't want you to start to doubt him now. But if I'm going to be his wife, he needs to tell me these things. I have to help him through difficulties, support him. That is what wives are for. Listen, I'm not certain about any of this, Marion says. It's all hearsay. I'm not sure that this is what is really troubling him, or that he didn't intend to tell you eventually. No, I'm quite sure you're right, Clara says. It's the only reasonable explanation. Please don't be hasty, Clara. Think before you say anything to him. Of course, I must draw him out on it. He must learn to trust me. She jumps to her feet and grabs Marion's hands. Almost at a run, she pulls her back towards the western end of the building where the others are, pausing only to kiss her on the cheek and say, "Thank you, you are such a good, wise friend." That must be it, Clara thinks. He's disappointed. His work was received badly, and he doesn't want to admit it. He is a man who has had a great deal of acclaim almost from the beginning of his career, and he is not accustomed to dealing with failure. He isn't even used to being disappointed, but she can help him learn to do this. Every artist will have good and bad times, and surely it is the love and support of their wives that get them through the difficulties. Look at Rodin and Rose Barret. Look at Amélie and Henri Matisse. Yes, helping him to accept this setback in London and move on from it will bring them closer than mere romance. It will be her first real act as his wife. As she walks towards where he is setting up his photographic equipment, she feels as though an entirely new chapter of her life is beginning. He sets his tripod up across from the western facade while the others wander around the immense perimeter of the cathedral. He can see them as vague shadows, in couples and threes, their individual figures nearly indistinguishable. If he peers closer, he can see Leo's beard and spectacles, and Mildred's slightly stooped form beside him. He can see Arthur pointing up at the flying buttresses and gremlins on one corner. He isn't sure if there will be enough light to capture this scene, but he will try with a flash bulb. He puts his eye to the viewfinder, and through it he sees one of the figures separate from the darkness at the side of the building. No, two figures, walking quickly and close together, one pulling the other along by the hand. Marion and Clara, though in the darkness and distance, he cannot tell which is which. One of the women stops near the main door of the nave, and the other continues to come towards him. As she gets closer, he sees it is Clara. "Stop there," he calls. "I wonder if I can get you in the cathedral together. Will you look out towards the river for me?" She obliges by turning away from him. "Is this right?" "Yes," he says. "Perfect. Just let me get the flash bulb set up. Don't move." He loves night photography because it can suggest forms without having to show them in stark detail. At night, the world softens, its distinctions blend, its objects bleed together into each other. Their imperfections are hidden. They can tell a larger story than they could if they were photographed straight. They can keep their mystery. It is a process that he can enhance later with brushes when he prints the exposures, altering them to make the forms less individuated and distinct. In this way, photography can ascend towards the level of painting as a means of creating beauty. It can become more fully an art. He will open up the camera and let in as much light as possible. The cathedral will not go anywhere, so he can afford to extend the exposure time. If Clara will just stay right where she is, there. He can just fit Marion's silhouette into the frame where she stands 20 feet further away, gazing up at the balustrades, two women, and the moon just risen in the black face of the river. "Hold still," he says to Clara. The flashbulb goes off and he takes the picture, but with night photography, it's hard to be certain it will come out. He wants to make sure he captures the scene. "Just one more," he says. "Darling," Clara says quietly. "Yes, my dear?" "I don't mean to bother you, but is everything quite all right? I mean, did everything go well in England this time?" He stops adjusting the camera and stands up straight so he can see her with his own eyes. "Yes, fine," he says. "Why?" His heart jumps in his chest. His palms feel suddenly damp. She knows. She must know. Otherwise, why these questions? But she doesn't seem angry or upset. If he looks at her, she seems almost to be glowing, her eyes shining and calm. "You seem a little out of temper, that's all. I just want you to know that if anything happened that was, well, unexpected or even bad, you can tell me about it. I won't be upset or doubt you. If I'm going to be your wife, my purpose is to help you through whatever happens, no matter what it is." He stares at her. He is speechless. "I'm sorry," she says. "You seemed upset, so I asked people about it. I know you had an incident with an acquaintance there. Forgive me for going behind your back about it." Does he know this woman, standing not 10 feet from him, whom he has courted and loved for nearly a year now? Does he have any idea of the depth of her generosity, her greatness of spirit? He would never have predicted this from her. If anything, though he loves her, desires her, he has felt at times a certain parochial rigidity to her opinions and ideas. He has suspected her of not really being very free-thinking after all. How has he misjudged her so thoroughly? This is more extraordinary than he could even have supposed. She does know about Kathleen, and she has chosen to rise above it, to recognize it for the folly that it was. In his surprise, he forgets to wonder who knew and who has told her. He goes to her and kneels and puts his arms around her waist and buries his head in her skirt. "My love," he says, "do you really mean it?" "Of course I do," she said serenely. "Every word. I wanted to tell you. As soon as I saw you, I wanted to tell you about her, but I was afraid of what you would say." He looks up, in time to see the smile freeze on her face as she takes in his words. Something, he realizes, has gone terribly wrong. "Her?" she asks. "Thank you."